Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN. The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit VoiceAmericaVariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Good morning and welcome to our show today. We've got a great show planned for you. In a few minutes, I'll introduce you to Nicole Christian. She's the founder and chief believer of the Circle Fund, a Bread for the Journey partner in Detroit, Michigan. Circle Fund's a great organization run by volunteers who devote their time and resources to help promising young children grades 3 through 8 participate in educational enrichment opportunities that would otherwise be out of reach for them. But before we begin with Nicole, I'd like to start with our World of Good segment. In honor of Thanksgiving, I've collected three stories for you today. My first story begins with a young man named Reed Sandridge. Reed lost his job in 2009 and did just the opposite of what most of us would do if we lost our job. He started giving away $10 a day to complete strangers. He captured the story of every recipient on a website called yearofgiving.org. He calls himself a kindness investor. And this is one of the remarkable stories Reed has written and posted on his site. Quote, I met David Gare on the corner of Connecticut and Q in D.C. while he was selling the Street Sense newspaper. Homeless in D.C. for 10 years, David hails from Kenya. I gave him $10 and we began a conversation. At one point, I asked David if he needed anything that I could include in the Lend a Hand program. He thought for a moment and then said he would like to find his cousin and find out more about his father. One of six children and the only son, David has lost touch with most of his family. The last time I saw my dad was 1985, he said. He said he'd like to know what happened to his father, Tom Nyamongo, who went to Harvard in the 1980s. David said he would also like to find a cousin of his named Ben Bella Jaoko, who was like a big brother to him. So with the power of the internet, I posted their names on the Year of Giving website and asked that if anyone knew them, to contact me. 6 months later, the most incredible thing happened. Someone who was going to a job interview at a company in Poland Googled the hiring manager for the job to learn a little bit more about him. Something we all do today, right? The hiring manager's name was Ben Bella Jaoko. Well, would you believe the interviewee also found my post on the internet about his cousin David looking for Ben? And at the end of the interview, asked Ben if he knew that he had a cousin in the U.S. who was looking for him. Completely shocked, Ben wasted no time contacting me, and we connected by phone, and I put him and David in contact. From that moment on, Ben worked tirelessly to make arrangements for David to get back to Kenya to be reunited with his family. I'm happy to report that 1 year later, David departed on Tuesday, November 21st, for Kenya. End of story. But I want to say that this is an abbreviated version of the story. But if you go to the Year of Giving website, you can read the full report on the friendship that developed between Reed and David. It began with a $10 gift and a conversation with a homeless man selling newspapers on a corner in Washington, D.C. My second Thanksgiving Day story comes from the website dailygood.org. Josh Farron picked up the keys to his family's first home last week, and as he opened the attic door hatch and climbed up, he saw a box that looked like a World War II ammunition case. Then he found seven more, all stuffed full with tightly wound rolls of cash, about $45,000 in all. Farron thought about how such a large sum of money could go a long way, pay bills, buy things he never thought he could afford. Instead, he returned it to the children of the man who previously lived and died in the house. Josh said, "I'm not perfect. I wish I could say there was never any doubt in my mind. But the money wasn't ours to keep, and I don't believe you get a chance very often to do something radically honest, to do something ridiculously awesome for someone else. That is a lesson. That is a lesson I hope to teach my children." And that's from the dailygood.org website. And my third Thanksgiving Day story also comes from a website, the same website, dailygood.org. They have a segment called Everyday Heroes, and it begins this way. My husband died in 1998, and the following year found me incredibly depressed, desperately lonely, and totally overwhelmed. I was living over 2,000 miles from my family, and his family had disappeared as if I had the plague. A friend invited me into her large, beautiful home, which was several states away, to live there with her, free of charge. I was hesitant, but 18 months after I became a widow, I moved into her home. Not only did I live with her for over a year, but when my property finally sold, she accompanied me on the long drive home, 14 hours, and we used her car, as it was newer and much more comfortable than mine. When I finally got my own place, she said that she knew I could never pay her back financially, and she didn't ever want that. But instead, she said that someday if I got the opportunity to pass it on to someone else who needed some help, to do it. And that generosity need not be financial. What she did for me was immeasurable. And in 2005, with Hurricane Katrina, I was finally able to pay her back by helping someone else in the manner she had done for me. Needless to say, I will never, ever forget her generosity, and I find it only fitting that I look for ways, no matter how small, to share a little kindness with others every day. It was hard to decide who would be my World of Good action hero this week. Should it be Reed Sandridge, the kindness investor? Josh Farron, the man who returned the $45,000? Or the woman whose name we don't know, who helped her friend who was mired in grief, and the friend who reached out to a stranger whose life was turned upside down in a hurricane? They all win by being stand-up people. We all win by learning about their stories, and we win doubly if we let those stories sink in and inspire us to do something kind for someone when we can. Thanksgiving is what you make it. And now I'd like to introduce you to Nicole Christian, and I'll begin with a quote from Clarissa Pinkola Estes because I think it's fitting for the interview today. And the quote begins this way. "It is not given to us to know which acts or by whom will cause the critical mass to tip toward an enduring good. What's needed for dramatic change is an accumulation of acts. Adding, adding to, adding more, continuing. We know that it does not take everyone on earth to bring justice and peace, but only a small determined group who will not give up during the first, second, or hundredth gale." Nicole Christian is the person who comes to mind when I read this quote. Despite hardships and through the first, second, or hundredth gale, she remains determined. She is the founder and chief believer of the Circle Fund, a Bread for the Journey partner in Detroit, Michigan. The Circle Fund is a great organization run by volunteers who devote their time and resources to help promising young children grades 3 through 8 participate in educational enrichment opportunities that would otherwise be out of reach for them. We're going to be talking about something Nicole and I call the 3 G's, grief, gratitude, and generosity. Nicole was born drug addicted. Both parents were dead by the time she was 14, and yet she defied the odds and became an award-winning journalist who has worked for the New York Times, Time Magazine, and the Wall Street Journal. But today, she gets her greatest pleasure from helping young people. Let's begin this interview now, where we'll learn about the trajectory of Nicole's remarkable life and perhaps come away with a few tips for remaining creative, inspired, and gracious in these difficult times. Good morning, Nicole, and happy Thanksgiving.
Good morning, Marianas. Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
It's great. I'd like to begin our interview today at the beginning of your life. You were born drug addicted, and your grandmother and aunt, as I understand it, were the ones who were really there for you. What of those early years do you remember, and do you know what the drug was that was in your system?
I grew up with my mother's mom, and I had the good fortune of her dad too. So my grandparents, Granny and Papa is what we called them. And actually, my mother lived in the house with us for a while, as did two of her sisters, my aunts. And the story goes, my grandmother would tell me this story, and kind of like one of the things, I think all grandmothers pass things down, and she tells the story about this little baby who was born kind of looking like a, shaking like a rat, and kind of came into the world really sickly. And it was often a disconnect for me that she was actually talking about me. And that I was born drug addicted, and heroin is pretty much, you know, my mother used a number of things. Heroin is what I'm persuaded by my grandmother to believe that I was fighting off. And in my years growing up, my mother was addicted to prescription pills. Is mostly the only thing I ever saw her taking, but not having the knowledge, having a child's knowledge at the time, I did not know. I just knew that there was something different about my mother. I didn't know that necessarily. It would take me a while to understand that the pills were straight up a drug for her.
Right.
But I could tell, I mean, there were always signs to me as I got older, you know, just by the signs of her hands, just indentations that she was, drugs were a part of her life. And the older I got, the more I learned.
Mm. Nicole, what do you think were the biggest factors in your childhood that helped you overcome such a difficult beginning?
It's funny because I think when you're going through something, especially as a child, I mean, a child's eyes are so much different than an adult's eyes. And I try to go back sometimes to when I was a kid and like what were the things that sort of persuaded me or just pushed me. And I like to believe that having a semblance of family, as imperfect as it was, I don't know that there's a such thing as a perfect family, but I had a place to land, but it was so, I was always kind of curious about this idea of normalcy, you know, like what would it be like to have a real mother? And my curiosity, there's always something beyond that I was curious about. And I think that I would meet it in teachers or meet it in strangers who would constantly tell me they saw something in me. And I don't know if it was a combination of pity just for, you know, the life circumstances. I like to think not. Or if it was just a sort of sense of another human being sensing my curiosity, my kind of hunger for a little bit more, you know. And I think that hunger really just grew out of, I think it's innate in everyone. You come into the world and you come through, we all come through the same process, a mother and a father. And there's some things that we're told that that connection give. And I can honestly say that I did not feel, I longed for that, even though I couldn't name it. I couldn't name it. And so I always thought it existed beyond. So I was curious. I would go to the thing that I thought could give me meaning. If I did this, it would give me meaning. If I, you know, and books gave me a lot of meaning. teachers gave me a lot of meaning because they would give feedback and validation. So curiosity, I think if you had to boil it down, it's just curiosity. And as time grew on, that word sort of morphed into other things. But as a kid, I was just intensely curious.
And I know you now as an adult. I'll say to our listeners, Nicole contacted me one day about wanting to start a chapter, a partnership of Bread for the Journey in Detroit, Michigan, and so began a conversation about the possibilities of working together. And now Nicole serves on the board of directors of the National Bread for the Journey organization. And so I've known you through a few different things over the past year and a half. And I think I would add to your sense that you probably have an inborn sense of optimism. Would you agree with me? Do you think that's true?
I would agree with you, but I'll tell you that, just talking candidly, that optimism is something that's come on because as a kid, the other mix through curiosity, there was a great time of anger too, and just hostility of wanting to do more to understand why I had to grow up the way I did. And I didn't grow up, don't let me suggest in any way that I grew up not having square meals. And my grandfather was an auto worker and he worked hard and we ate and we had all those things. I had a house, grew up in a big, fairly strong working class neighborhood. And so I didn't have the want of shelter and those types of things, but mm-hmm. the other aspect, that the inborn, that inner stuff was not settled. So I think curiosity, anger, but as time has gone on, you know, definitely optimism, because I'm able to look back and say, wow, if not for others, it could have turned out so differently.
Right. It could have turned out so differently. Oh, great. We're going to take a short break. To our listeners, please stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue speaking more with our guest, Nicole Christian. Please stick around. Take care and thank you.
News. Opinion. Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you ready to live a powerful life based in vitality, joyfulness, and satisfaction? Is it time to take action and design a life you've always known you could live? Tune it to Design Your Life, Coaching for New Choices with Master Certified Coach Patricia Hirsch. You'll explore what stops you from going after your dreams and be supported in a future you design to pull you forward from the present. Tune in every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time for Design Your Life, Coaching for New Choices on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
There are a number of health and social services available to individuals for low cost or no cost. Now there's a radio program devoted to bringing you the information you need. Tune in to Outreach Today with host Melissa Jenkins-Simon. Our program promotes the benefits and services of CI Incorporated, providing health and social services over a wide spectrum of resources and agencies. We want to help you. Tune in to Outreach Today, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
We're back, and we're talking to Nicole Christian, founder and chief believer of the Circle Fund, a Bread for the Journey partner in Detroit, Michigan. And when we ended last time, we were talking a little bit about optimism, and I wanted to say to you, Nicole, I didn't mean to imply that optimism wasn't something you worked hard to accomplish or achieve when I said it was an inbred thing. I have just known you for a year, year and a half, and it's such a strong part of your personality that I had a sort of tendency to believe that it's something you always possessed.
You know, it's funny because I think it was. It's one of those things that really was always there, but I had to get to it. Like anything, you had to kind of move through it so I could see it as another one of the roots. I was sort of focused on that one root system and the breaks in that root system and thinking that that was my story, that's all there was, and I had to just deal with that. I didn't know that I got a chance to kind of, you know, dig around and make a more complete picture. And as I did, and with the help of so many people, I mean, I'm just completely a tapestry of other people's belief and giving and sharing, that's all that I am. And I get a chance to sort of look at that and say, I can't be anything but hopeful. Mm-hmm. Because like with every story has a beginning, and mine was just, it could have gone a lot of different ways. And I know that to be true by the kids who grew up around me and their choices. And it's not like I had anything handed to me that definitely secured that I was going to go one way and these other kids were going to go another way. But as I began to just look and say, you know, look at the sacrifices and just look at people's belief in me, I used their belief in me to fuel me. And when I looked up, it's just this thing that you get. Life is, you can't help but be a little bit more hopeful if you get another day.
Right. It's true. It's so true. I was reading something about your life, and there was a quote that you said that sort of struck me. You said, "My mom died on her birthday in my bedroom. She was 36 years old, and Nicole, you were 13. And I'm wondering what the relationship was like with your mother when she was around, and what impact she had on you that remains today?
That's a really good question. The relationship, again, I looked at it, I have to look at it as I looked at it then, that's through a child's eyes. Mm-hmm. And I had a great sense of anger for my mother because I wanted her there. But I was constantly reminded that it looked to me like she was choosing something else. Mm-hmm. And that other thing was more important. And that other thing was, you know, drugs or, you know, time she spent in jail, just other things that took her away. And I let that anger drive me for a long time that I didn't really, I would resent if anyone told me that there was a physical resemblance between us. And it took me years to begin to just kind of carve that away. And I can tell you, on the day she died, my family, they were, you know, understandably in grief and pain. And I didn't cry. I felt a kind of sense of almost release. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad would die 9 months later. And that had more effect on me because in a child's eyes, through my childlike eyes, I had vilified her and sort of, you know, canonized him. Mm. And undeserved it, you know, but a kid, what does a kid know? You know what you see.
Right.
And I saw my mother's absence, and my father, I didn't grow up in the house with him, but he was always, you know, there for the milestone moments, you know, kindergarten, take me shopping. He was the one to buy me my first bra, that type of thing. I saw E.T. with my father, so I had these memories with him and with her for a long time. I equated longing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's morphed in a weird way because now, as a woman and a mother myself, I find myself trying to fill in the blanks that I can never really fill in. Even as a writer, I'm always just going to wonder. But I've learned that people are three-dimensional and that every story is made up of a number of things. So I'm more curious about her, and I have a great sort of and this sounds weird even to me, but I have a respect for the things about her that I don't know, the sort of influencer story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to give her a little bit of, to give her memory, a little bit of grace.
Yeah, yeah. Another quote that you said about this, not to stay too long on this, but I think it's an important part of the foundation. You said, on my 37th birthday, something compelled me to find her gravesite. I took with me the only picture that I have of us. I let go that day, and I finally saw my mom as a three-dimensional person. Did my mom make some mistakes? Yeah, hers were messier than most. But I told myself, Nicole, you're still here. Let it go. And I'm wondering what letting go means in a practical sense. Is it like letting go of that anger, of wishing it could have been different, of your mind wondering questions that really are unanswerable? What did letting go really mean to you at that point? You're 37 years old.
Letting go, it meant a mixture of all of that, because I've been carrying this thing around, and not even, you know, you think if you are angry with someone, you're still carrying them. Mm-hmm. Anger is like a really, it's a great waste of time. And when I think at how much time I wasted explaining when I would speak up about my own story, it always started with, you know, or somehow in the first part of any beginning was my mother died when I was 13, and it would just bring me back to this place. And I just frankly got tired of carrying it. I didn't really realize I was even carrying it. So it meant I gave myself a blank canvas. And in doing that, I began to, in a weird way, I felt like I got a piece of her back, because I could just sort of see she was human and I'm still human. Mm-hmm. And there's really, as much as I wanted to separate myself from her, here's the great joke. None of us are separate. So
that's right.
I guess I started carrying her in a different way.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. It's a good progression. I think it's an experience that lots of people have when they finally do let go of all the anger. Then they can accept the person, you know, and maybe their good aspects.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, at the Super Bowl, or at the end of the Super Bowl, they ask, you know, so what are you going to do now? And I felt like, you know, God was sort of saying to me, okay, so what are you going to do now? You got a blank canvas. And that became scarier to me. Dropping the story and having to flesh out the canvas became scarier to me than walking around as, you know, this motherless child who had, and I'm not belittling my story, I'm just saying that there's so much more.
Right. Well, we move from a place of being a victim to taking then control of our life. And so, oh my God, a blank canvas. I'm in charge here.
And it's completely scary. Oh God, who gave me the letters?
Right. So you, at 16 years old, you began working in a newsroom. You were the first in your family to go to college. Later, you became a journalist for the New York Times, Time Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, and many others. Did journalism at that time then perhaps become the anchor in your life that you never had with your parents, do you think?
I think so. And at 16, I was more high school paper. I didn't get into internships until I was in college, and I got the great fortune to get a scholarship to college. It became the anchor, but it was a progression, because there were teachers in high school who started to really sort of turn the light on for me. And it, even beyond high school, but really it clicked in high school, because I think I was on this, I was on the run. I was running toward this thing. And the thing in a lot of cases was just a sense of going to go find approval somewhere in the world. I'm going to anchor myself on something. And anchor was not the word that I used then, but it was a sort of sense of belonging, just a base level need to belong somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in, you know, from books to newspapers, and I could be present but still hide behind the byline. You know?
Right. So, right. Yeah.
And it was a gift. I mean, I'm completely grateful to Wayne State University. Detroit has an amazing program, a program called, at the time, Journalism. The Journalism Institute for Minorities, and it an academic merit-based scholarship program that helped me to become the first person in my family to go to college, and life-changing, just completely life-changing.
Does the program still exist?
It does still exist.
It's great.
The name has changed, but it's still at Wayne State University, and it created a generation of young journalists just like me.
That's great. So you were one of the journalists who worked for the New York Times when the attacks of 9/11 occurred. I understand you wrote several of the profiles in Courage, the series that won a Pulitzer Prize. I read sort of a philosophical statement from you about the interviews. You said, I came away from 9/11 thinking, I don't want to be an incomplete story. When I die, I want to die completely empty. Can you explain that?
Yeah. You know, I think it goes back to this notion of having suddenly, with this canvas in my hand, what am I going to do with it? And knowing that there, you know, we come into the world, and I believe we all come with skills and gifts and, in some ways, assignments and other things happen, but it's what choices will you make that you get to use up everything that you came here to do? Mm-hmm. And I kind of, I want to feel like I got a chance to really engage my life, to sort of use the ticket and get all my stamps. And that's just how I choose to live now. I don't want a big bag of regrets to, oh, I didn't do this or I didn't, because every day we're choosing.
Right.
Even when we're not choosing, we're still choosing.
Right.
So I kind of want to choose, you know, a certain number of laughs a day, and that doesn't mean hard times don't come. I'm not trying to sell anyone on some Pollyannic notion of living, but I do know from my own experience and from the experience of being a journalist and taking in other people's stories for a couple of decades, life is a lot richer than we really ever open ourselves up to.
Right.
You know, the hours are a lot longer than the moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I want to use mine well.
Right. So today you don't call yourself a journalist anymore. You're, as I understand it, tired of chronicling the world. You want to live in it. You have a 9-year-old daughter, Asia Elise, who has a Bengali name, beautifully, which means hopeful life consecrated to God, and a devoted husband of 20 years, Wayne, and your grandmother is still alive and active in your life. In a few minutes, when I want to talk about the Circle Fund, and we're going to talk about grief, moving to generosity. But before we go there, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your family life today.
Well, I was gifted with my daughter, Asha. She was born in New York shortly after 9/11. And I'll tell you, it's like I've got this great teacher who's just been plopped down into my life. She's 9, and all the cliches they tell you about parenting come true. But she's taught me some things about myself, and she's made me more patient, just really connected me to life in a deeper way. And you think when you're a journalist, you're out, you're covering the story, you're seeing life, but yeah, that's still from a distant vantage point. Being a parent and being not even, you don't have to just be a parent, but choosing something to really put your focus into, that really engages life. And that's what she's done for me. And I love being a mother. And I think, I hope to say it's my greatest work.
And you've been married for 20 years to your husband. He's a teacher.
Yeah, well, he's a former teacher. He's my high school sweetheart, so we like to joke that we've gone through a lot of hair phases together. So, yeah, he's seen me. We started dating shortly after 10th grade and went through college together and just been the best of friends.
Oh, you know, that's a real gift. That is a real special gift to have long and strong relationship over time. And your grandmother is still alive and active in your life. She lives in Detroit. You live in Detroit, yes?
Yes, she does. She's 90 and she's still around. And I had to break the news to her that the economy had sort of changed my career for me, moving me from a journalist into another living being. But she's still here and she's just as pleased with the life I'm living now.
Oh, so great to hear that. So great to hear that. So we're going to take a break in a minute here, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about your new nonprofit organization, the Circle Fund, a Bread for the Journey partner in Detroit. And we're going to be talking about the trajectory of grief to generosity, grief, gratitude, generosity, and as you like to say, grace. So for those of us who are listeners, for those in the group listeners, please stick with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Thank you so much.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk. Yeah! If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you exploring the changes in your life? We are continually evolving our lives into wellness, tranquility, and personal power. When you open your mind and heart to your spiritual strength and power within, you create the most wonderful and meaningful life. Unlock the infinite power of your mind and your creative being. Tune in to This Amazing Life with Dr. Phil Nernberger, live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel, and explore the strength and wisdom that comes from within.
Explore the power and beauty in yourself and in others. Tune in to The Stacey Stern Show, Enriching You. Every week, Stacey Stern will connect you with men and women who are living and working from a place of passion. Stacey's guests include successful authors, filmmakers, actors, experts, and leaders. You'll hear what inspires each of them, and you'll be turned on to great films, books, and new media. Tune in to The Stacey Stern Show, Enriching You, Tuesdays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Now there's a new destination for video content, VoiceAmerica.tv, just like our radio channels and so much more. Voice America Variety, Health and Wellness, Business, Sports, Green Talk, Power Up Motorsports, and Seventh Wave Network now have their own video channel components. Plus, check out exclusive programming, including movies, music, educational courses, science and history, current events, and short features. High-definition, premier-quality programs available 24/7. VoiceAmerica.tv. If you think you've seen online TV like this before, let us surprise you.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
We are back, and we're talking to Nicole Christian, founder and chief believer of the Circle Fund, a Bread for the Journey partner in Detroit. So, Nicole, the Circle Fund is run by volunteers who devote their time and resources to helping promising young children, grades 3 through 8, participate in educational enrichment opportunities that would otherwise be out of reach for them. I was, as we were going through the interview, I was thinking so much about how you were a kid, when you talked about your teachers being an important factor, people in your life, you were a kid like the kids you're serving today. Is that really where the motivation came to focus on this particular group of kids?
It's exactly where it came from. I mean, the name is a very decided choice because I do believe that life is a circle. And when you really look at that, it's a sobering thought that, you know, It sounds like a cliche, but it's true. It's a circle, and it's completed by a lot of actions, empowered by generosity. I mean, that's my story,
mm-hmm.
But it's also the story of so many other people. So the idea that to be a part of a circle, to have benefited from a circle, well, you keep the circle going,
mm-hmm.
and it's something I'd wanted to do for I guess years, and I've been doing like in small measure, giving here and giving there, and it's still small. The Circle Fund, it's not something that I think needs to necessarily grow into some mammoth effort. And that's the thing about giving; it does not have to be huge to be meaningful.
Right.
But I wanted to really make it a part of my life, and giving, I mean, whatever my life turns into over the next chapters, it will, giving's always going to be at the center. And the idea to repay some of what, you know, in some small measure, some of what's been given to me, I think is sort of the highest thank you for the people who gave me opportunities and helped me do things that as a kid, I didn't even see the importance of. I didn't fully know it, because you can't fully know it. But as I look back, I'm like, wow, if this teacher hadn't done that, if this, sometimes not necessarily stranger, but sort of just a person has popped around in your life and they're not necessarily a relative, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
They make small investments and all those things sort of, they add up.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to be that for another kid in what I consider foundational years, it's kind of a gift. And it's kind of a gift to be able to be of service, and not to think that your one act is going to change, necessarily be the full catalyst for changing a kid's life, but it does contribute. And if, you know, just to be of service, yeah, it does contribute.
Yeah. I remember there were, you know, people say, who are the most important people? Sometimes for me, it was one person who said one thing that has stuck in my mind forever, that added to the little bag of encouraging things that I held onto in my life that, you know, were important to me. So sometimes even the smallest interaction makes the biggest difference and stays the longest. I think it's, yeah.
And if you really, I mean, I challenge people sometimes, if you were to get a blank sheet of paper, or even a notebook, and just sit down and really go through your life, you'd be amazed how many different roles people have played that sort of added up to where you are right now.
That's right.
And not just the people who did great things, but the people who weren't there too. It all adds up.
So you've talked about a teacher in your life. You've mentioned teachers a couple of times. In the way that you work out the Circle Fund, do teachers play a role at all?
I think teachers, well,
explain how the whole thing works, who you're serving, how it works, and how teachers play a role if they do.
It's, we've tried to keep it fairly simple, just because at the end of the day, you want to get the kid engaged and you want to make sure that you're creating this circle that they can see themselves, not just as a recipient, but as a participant. So at the center of it is engaging with kids who have some basic sense of service, and that they have an idea, a need that they want to fulfill for themselves, something they're curious about. Maybe it's summer camp, or maybe it's, you know, continuing violin lessons, or just something that sort of enriches them, and they don't really necessarily have the access to it,
mm-hmm,
or the mm-hmm ability to continue it. So if they've got that basic route, in exchange, we ask, well, what are you going to do? What would you like, if you had the opportunity, how would you serve your school or your community? And the idea there is to plant that seed that, you know, there's an exchange, there's constant exchange. You know, we all have to give something to move forward. And that's the hope, that while they remember the grant that was paid on their behalf to an organization, they'll remember the project that they came up with. And they have to complete the project. The students have to sort of pair with someone, an adult representative in the school, to actually carry out the project that they come up with. I'll get to just flesh it out. The first project we ever did was a young girl in eighth grade who, when asked what she would do if she had some money to be of service in her community, she thought about her school, and she thought about something I don't think many of us would even occur to us. She got tired of like sticking her legs beneath desks that were where the tops of the bottom of the desk was just covered in gum. So she wanted to take one teacher's classroom and just scrape the gum out so kids could, she thought, focus better. I was kind of, the simplicity of it blew me away for one specific reason, that she cared so much about her environment that she was focused on something that if she were disengaged, she would have long since forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
And what she, you know, she'd never been to summer camp. So she has this notion she wants to be a veterinarian. So we were able to find a program at the local zoo that sort of gave her a bit of a more close-up experience with animals. It was her first trip to summer camp. And that was really a good experience for the folks who form our little board, but also just for her and for the community, because Detroit is a place sometimes where people think that all the kids are adding, moving in the same direction, and they're not going to necessarily end up to anything. But there are kids who have basic desires, and they just want to know that they're not out there pushing by themselves. And they've got the drive, they've got the will, and we just wanted to sort of give a small push.
Right. So here's a kid who never has been to a summer camp, is interested in being a veterinarian. You find a summer camp for her, get her enrolled, get her there every day. She has this experience of being able to be right. with animals and begin to think about perhaps living out a dream of being a veterinarian. And in exchange for getting the grant and being able to do this, she galvanizes a bunch of friends, and they work.
She completed this project.
Yes.
They completed this project, and they completed it over a series. I mean, she had to scope out the project. She had to spec it out. She had to find volunteers. She had to build a sense of teamwork amongst the volunteers. And beyond the camp, you know, she told me that the biggest lesson for her was that she used to only want to work by herself.
Ah.
And she could work with others. And it taught her that she could, because she had to lead this thing. Mm-hmm. We sent, there was a teacher, the principal at the school, and another teacher were her on-site support. But we also had a wraparound of a volunteer, you know, my husband, who with his teaching skills, and a couple of board members. We actually, you know, checked on, you know, helped her go through her project, you know, questioned the logic of it, because they had to come up with the expense of getting the products to even discover what was going to take, what type of product would you need to even take gum from beneath the desk.
Right.
So it's engaging the, you know, the intellectual, the community skills, leadership skills. It was eye-opening.
And then you had a volunteer day where your board members attended, the teachers were there, this young girl and the friends that she had gotten involved and committed as volunteers, and you all worked together to help clean, I don't know, what was it, 35 desks or something?
I think the number came out to be 33. So on the final day of cleaning, they had a day of prep, the day of cleaning. We just came in and we let her give us tasks, and we got it done.
Yeah, I love that story. And it's also a lot like in the way the Bread for the Journey works, in that we don't go into a community and say what we think that community needs. What we really do is stay open to what the people in the community come forward with and say, this is what I'd like to see improved in my community. This is what I'm prepared to do to improve it. I need perhaps, you know, a number of resources. I need 10 volunteers. I need $300. I need the support of the community to know that this is something that they want as well. And then we sort of get behind them and encourage them and say yes. And it sounds to me like your chapter was a perfect example of the way the whole organization runs. Very exciting. It was a very exciting story to me.
Yeah, trying to keep it simple, because people have busy lives, but giving does not have to be complicated.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking about this, you know, this trajectory of, you know, in my life, you know, I'll just say that, you know, when I went through, for those of you who perhaps don't know this story, my best friend was murdered when I was a child. And so I had a real deep grief in my life, and I didn't really begin to deal with it until I was in my 20s. But when I finally emerged out of that difficult time, I remember my therapist saying to me, what do you want to do next? And the words that came out of my mouth immediately were that I wanted to create a center for children and families grieving a death as close to the time of the death as possible. And I went on to create this center. And I see this now again and again in all kinds of people, and you're another example of this. Somebody who's been through something very difficult, and we have this grief that we carry with us no matter all the ways that it shows up. And then when we come to a place of healing and we're beginning to, you know, ready to move on, sort of the first thing we think about is how we can serve others. Can you comment a little bit on how that was for you? And have you seen it in other people as well?
I think I've seen it. Anyway, I watched a lot as a journalist, but it's become a driving force for me, because in the end, I think that's all there really is, service. You just choose what you're serving.
Right.
You know, and in the service of good, and not the cliched hackneyed sense of good, but just in the service that, that the choices you make in your life are additive, additive to your own experience or additive to somebody else's. And that to me is sort of sweet living, the chance to really make a conscious effort to say, you know, how can I be of service? Because I guarantee you, in the process of being of service, you're being served in a lot of cases much more than the person you think you're serving.
So true.
And I think there's a difference between helping and service. You know, helping sort of empowers this notion that you want to help can sometimes put you in a perspective of being empowered over the thing you're trying to help, and you're really not.
Right.
So that's the thing. That's the lesson that I want my daughter to know, that, you know, just figure out what you want to serve and show up. And you get the benefits of showing up for service. Right.
One of the things I noticed for me as well, too, is that when I have a moment of spaciousness or freedom from my whatever story that might be troubling me, and have a moment of gratitude, some experience where I am open to the idea of how grateful I am for what I have in my life, then the next thing that rolls right out is generosity. They feel like very much like they go together. You know, we only have a few more minutes, but I wonder if you can say a little bit about that, and perhaps even grace that you speak about often, Nicole.
Yeah, I think the easiest analogy for me is that it's like peanut butter and jelly. They fit.
Mm.
You know, you carry something, but once you put yourself in the place of another, the thing you're carrying gets lighter. It just inevitably gets lighter because generosity is an action, and it requires a committed focus. And anything that whatever you focus on, it changes you.
Mm-hmm.
It changes you. And so I think for me, it's not that I fixate on being generous. I just realized that generosity has shaped me, and I've just decided to participate in it, to really, in simple ways. Sometimes it's empowering just to smile at a person. Mm-hmm. That's an act of generosity that a lot of people underestimate. You know, not just writing a check, but just to smile, to inquire about, you know, to ask somebody how they're doing, but to ask it from a real sincere place, you know, not in a robotic manner. How you doing today? And really listen. Give people the gift of your eyes when you're talking to them. That's generous.
It's really generous. You're right. You're so right.
And it just never stops. It's a circle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so many times when I think that I'm the one giving, I really, in reality, am the one receiving. I get so much more. I get so much more than what I'm giving.
Yeah, and you have to, you know, I don't want to make it sound saccharine, because I think there can become a time for the giver when the giver overgives.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that you enjoy life when you engage with it, when you really engage with it. And your story, you know, your story gets depth because it's not just all about you.
Right. That's right. Well, thank you. I'm going to close this interview with a quote that I read that you stated. And one of the things I read about you, Nicole, it's just a beautiful thing. You said, every day you wake up, you get to make a choice. You're either living by default or design. Well, I'm living and learning in a mess, and I'm cool with that. That's really what success is, being willing to stumble and realizing that in your stumble is your power to stand. Thank you so much, Nicole, for taking time today to be with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah. And to our listeners, if you would like to make a contribution to Nicole's Circle Fund, you can do it through our national office at breadforthejourney.org. If you go onto our website, follow the donate button, and make a contribution and put something in the notation that says it is for the Circle Fund. And the same is true for Bread for the Journey National. If you'd, we're finally heading into the end of the year, and we're heading into our year-end fundraising season. And with this economic downturn, The coffers are in need of replenishment, and if you can find a place in your heart to support the work of the Circle Fund of Bread for the Journey chapter or Bread for the Journey International, the national office that makes all of the chapters possible, we hope you'll go to our website at breadforthejourney.org. We believe that if everyone pitches in a little bit, we can change the world. And I close with this on Thanksgiving weekend. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free. See you next week.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.